Matt Segundo here, and I'm pleased to report that this is the final Book Expo podcast. Attrition set in for our young roving correspondent, and I was pleased to see him falter. It's always good to see a needlessly effusive man roast in his own effluvium, particularly when he insists upon interviewing everyone from warehouse workers to the deranged lunatics behind some of these New Age inspiration houses. Ha, ha. But before we proceed anew, I'd like to address a certain controversy that has spread across the internet, and I'd like to do this in poetic meter. This is a poem I've written myself. Cheenie, Cheenie, you're a sweetie. Would you like a bowl of Wheaties? If you're a man, here's Jorge's hand. This isn't love, you understand. A surrogate until such time as I might learn to woo with rhyme. The bottle can't restore my soul, but maybe with the cereal bowl, I'll fondle soon a woman's breast and feel my thrust upon her chest. So there you have it, kids. You see, what I sought from Matt Cheney was not what you thought. Now, if you'll excuse me, the parking garage is calling me into work, and of course, I need all the extra money that I can.
Okay, I am here with Eric Reynolds of Fantagraphics Books, who has not just Peanuts here, but a new cartoon compendium. Maybe you can describe about this.
Well, we're doing Hank Ketchum's Complete Dennis the Menace. We're collecting all the strips from the 1950s and onward. A lot of people probably don't appreciate Dennis as much as, say, Peanuts, which, you know, has a sort of universal belovedness. And Dennis doesn't have quite the cultural cachet of Penis, but that's because people don't realize how good the strip was in the early 50s. It got a little bit diluted as it went on, and assistants started working on it and everything. Unlike Peanuts, where Schultz was the only person who ever touched the strip.
Yeah.
But these early 50 strips that Ketchum did are really great. Dennis was a much more mischievous and impish character than the kind of softened version that you see now in the newspapers. And so we're collecting all the single panel daily strips that Ketchum did. And it's just, you know, one more in our growing library of classic comic strips.
Are there any sort of other comic strips that you might be, are you in talks with? Or
well, starting in September, the complete Popeye, the original E.C. Seegar strips. Seegar did the strip up until he died in 37, I believe. And he only did it for about 11 years. And so again, similar to Dennis, people don't realize what a fantastic comic strip Popeye was because it's been kind of watered down and diluted by the cartoons throughout the 20th century, which were, you know, reduced to this kind of ridiculously simple formula of Popeye and Bluto courting olive oil, Popeye eating the spinach, Popeye beating up Bluto, and, you know, happy ending for Olive and Popeye. None of that was ever in the original strip. The original strip was just this wild, farcical adventure strip, very vaudeville-esque cast of characters, you know, kind of picaresque, wild adventure. And it's my favorite strip of all time, and we're really excited to do the dailies and the Sundays complete for the first time.
Gotcha.
Okay. Well, anything else besides comic strips that you would like to talk about that's coming out?
Well, we publish a lot of contemporary graphic novels and cartoonists as well as the classic stuff, and we've been promoting Linda Medley's Castle Waiting here all weekend, and that's a book I'm really excited about. It's one of the rare kind of major graphic novels that's suitable for all ages, especially girls, which there's kind of an underserved niche in the graphic novel business, at least amongst anything that isn't manga. So we're pretty excited about that. We've got a new Art School Confidential book based on the movie by Terry Zwigoff and Dan Clowes. We're starting a new line of Love and Rockets paperbacks, reprinting all of the original 50 issues of Love and Rockets by Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. You know, all sorts of stuff. We do about 50 books a year, so there's plenty of stuff to talk about.
Eric, well, thanks very much.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I know you tried. I know you cried.
So I am here with Mark Bonelli, who has a book coming out with Dalkey Archive Press. Mark, maybe you can tell me about it.
The book is called Second Vanzetti Must Die! ! And it's loosely about Second Vanzetti, the Italian anarchists who were executed. But it's mostly made up. I did a lot of research for it, but then I ended up making up most of the details.
What attracted you to the subject exactly?
Well, I'm first generation Italian American, and in history class, I remember as a kid, post Columbus, really the only Italians who you'd ever hear about were Sacco and Vanzetti, these sort of sad martyred figures. And so I was always just, that was just kind of stuck with me. And then when I was older and realized that they were actually part of this extremely violent anarchist movement, the Italian anarchist wing was one of the most sort of violent, people today would say terrorist wings of the movement. And, it was just immediately fascinating to me. I think I found out more about it probably when I was in my 20s, and I just became a little bit more interested in anarchist history and started reading up about it, and realized that there was this whole sort of wing of Italian anarchist history that I didn't know about. So there was just a lot of really rich material there, and it immediately attracted me to it.
Were contemporary politics a sort of inspiration for this? Or?
Not really an inspiration, but as the more research I did, there were just a lot of, obvious parallels. There was one weird detail. I found an article from the New York Times. At one point during their trial, these anarchists bombed Wall Street. They pulled like a sort of a horse-drawn buggy, I think in front of the stock exchange, set off a bomb. And, I think maybe like 100 people were killed. But the descriptions in the New York Times piece were so eerily similar to the September 11th descriptions. I mean, there were big people running from huge clouds of smoke, and like windows were shattered from blocks away. And the weird thing was the bombing was, I think, on the September 18th, and they had been indicted on the 11th. So they were just, there's just lots of like weird little parallels like that.
Looks like the cycle runs exactly on the clock here.
Yeah, seriously. So anyway, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. I mean, the Second Vanzetti characters in my book are a fictional film comedy team. But anarchist stuff is sort of weaved in and out of the novel.
So anarchism, terrorism, and comedic duos.
Yeah, and that too. I mean, the more I sort of thought about the sort of classic comedy teams that I love, from like Abbott and Costello to the Marx Brothers to the Three Stooges. I mean, it's all about these guys sort of going into often like a high society or straight world setting and creating anarchy. Chaos. So it all kind of fit.
Keenan Arbuckle.
Seriously, yeah, all those guys. So so that was also a lot of fun to research that stuff and do that.
How much of this was sort of, did it come from your research? How much of this book was inspired by the research you did, and how much of it was inspired by your own sort of upbringing?
Well, there's one, in the book, they're a comedy team, and the sort of centerpiece of their act is they're supposed to be knife grinders, these Italian knife grinders, and they sort of juggle knives and throw knives around and do these very dangerous kind of crazy stunts. And my father and a lot of my relatives are actually knife grinders. They're from northern Italy in the Dolomites, in this little valley where it turns out lots of the knife grinders of the world are from. So so my dad was a knife grinder. He's retired now. Two of my uncles, my grandfather. I grew up in just outside of Detroit, and sort of, all of the major knife grinders in the Detroit metropolitan area were somehow related to me, and they you know, they would all kind of be competing for the same customers and stealing each other's customers, and it was a very, very kind of odd thing. So, so definitely, I worked some of that stuff in, and yeah, family history stuff definitely came into play.
Now, the exclamation mark in the title, do you think that there are not enough novels with exclamation marks? Or strange punctuation? Arcane punctuation?
I love an exclamation mark. Yeah, I was on the fence. I didn't want it to be too cute. But the more, you know, I showed it to people with and without the exclamation point, and it really felt right. And especially, it definitely fits the tone of the book. It's very, I don't know.
Maybe a critic might take you to task for drawing attention to with the exclamation mark. I mean,
that's
you know.
That's true.
Now, this is your first novel, correct?
It is.
Now, you do journalism as well?
Yes. I'm a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, so I've been a contributing editor there for about 6 years, and I write features, a lot of music stuff because it's Rolling Stone, but also just more general cultural stuff, and
What was the difference between, like, say, did you find that yourself taking lessons from journalism in terms of, like, you know, actually writing this novel? I mean, you know, there's a long tradition of journalists who have turned novelists, so.
Right. It feels like a very different part of my brain, I guess. I tried to write short stories before I did this, and none of them really turned out to my satisfaction. And so with this, when I started doing the research, that did feel closer to some of the journalism I do. But like I said, I mean, with the novel, I had the luxury of just kind of throwing out the research that didn't really interest me and making stuff up. But yeah, beyond that, it's very different. I mean, I love the nonfiction writing I do as well, but it's a lot easier for me, just because you've got a very specific parameters. You know, you've got this raw material, this interview you did with somebody, and you know whatever sort of scene stuff you have, and you have a kind of, you know, basic limited word count, and you know there are certain marks you have to hit, and you know within that context you can be fairly creative, but it's still different from staring at a blank piece of paper or a blank screen when you're writing a novel and knowing you can just do whatever you want.
Did you do a lot of interviews for the research of this book? I'm wondering if there were any sort of journalistic sort of techniques that were used to kind of, you know, prep things up and get you involved with the time and all that.
I didn't do any interviews. I did a lot of library research. There's a great the University of Michigan Library has a great anarchist special collection. So I spent about a week there, and then I went to Boston. They have a pretty substantial Sacramento Vanzetti archive, and then I would just go to bookstores and try to find kind of old out of print books about the terrors of anarchy, which is another sort of parallel to today. There are a lot of very hysterical books about anarchists, so that stuff was all great. But no, I didn't do any interviews.
Well, Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And he took on the likeness of man. He came to live in an ungodly world, though spotless the land.
Okay, I am at the Nightshade Books booth, and I am here with Matt Cheney, who is about to... Actually, wait a minute. There's some ethical compromising here. Why don't we discuss this?
Yes, deeply unethical, as I'm serving as a shyster and promoter of Nightshade Books, for whom I actually have reviewed some of their books. Mixed reviews often, sometimes, but they're producing such phenomenal books these days that, and they offered to bring me to BEA, so I said, well, why not? Let's see what happens.
Yes, a free lunch then.
A free lunch, yeah. Well, actually, no, I had to pay for lunch the other day. I haven't even really eaten many lunches so far.
You know, I haven't eaten a lot either, and I haven't slept a lot. It's like, it's like deprivation here.
I know, I'm really wary of anything that you're going to use from this interview because of sleep deprivation and nutritional deprivation and just surviving basically on caffeine at this point.
Yeah, well, same here, yeah. Same here. This is, incidentally, the last day of Book Expo. We should let everyone know.
Yes, this is the end of Book Expo. We have been book exposed.
Would you say you've got your fill, or did you get everything you needed to accomplish set here? Or?
Yes, I think so. I'm going home with piles of books from various publishers. Was able to tell people about a great small press. Met up with a bunch of people who I've known of for years and have never had a chance to meet face to face. So it was a great time.
That would be Kelly Link and Company.
No, Kelly Link I've known for a while.
Well, I just met her last night. So.
Yes, Kelly's great. Kelly and Gavin and all. No, actually meeting all of the lit bloggers was great, was really great fun. Finally meeting Gwenda Bond, meeting Wendy Kaufman, meeting Ed Champion.
Yeah, son of a bitch.
Yes.
No, the real, though, I guess Mr. Segundo you actually met, and he frightened the hell out of you, as I understand.
I did meet Mr. Segundo and was not prepared for that experience.
Well, what experience? Can you elaborate on this?
Mr. Segundo is vociferous.
Vociferous?
Vociferous in his exhortations of conflictual existence.
Conflictual existence.
Yes.
I mean, though his needs are very, very, shall we say, pathetic? I don't know.
I wouldn't say pathetic. I'd say loud.
Loud. Okay. Loud. Okay. Well, I have here Jeremy Larson, who is the man behind Nightshade. Maybe, and I had no idea you published as many great authors as you do. Maybe you could tell me more about this. And
well, Nightshade Books got started about 8 years ago. We got about 80 books in print right now. Do science fiction, fantasy, and horror, and the weird stuff that falls between those marketing categories.
Have these many of these books just not found any kind of, like, you know, literary press at all, or what's the situation?
We market pretty extensively to strictly genre outlets, and we've gotten enormous support from some of the cross-genre literary crossover literary fantasy markets. When we do writers like M. John Harrison, who's kind of like the poster child for kind of literary fantastic fiction, we get a lot of attention from the places that we normally don't have that kind of reach to.
Gotcha. Now, I understand you also successfully crashed the PGW party last night.
The key to successfully crashing a party is to wear a pimp suit. A zoot suit, have a big feather, and then just stride to the front of the line, make eye contact with nobody, and just say, VIP.
Why the zoot suit?
Well, there's about, 8,000, 6,000 publishers and publishing personnel in the convention here, and I had to stand out somehow, Jeans and a t-shirt, not going to do it. Charcoal gray conservative blazer, not going to do it. But a 12-inch red feather and a zoot suit down to my ankles, I got a lot of attention.
I should note, though, you delivered a very interesting 40-minute soliloquy to me last night about Trisha Sullivan. What's up with this?
When I get tired, when I'm in the groove, I'll talk until I'm hoarse about the books that I love, and that's what it was. I was just a little bit too enthusiastic, and I think I chewed on your ear a little bit too long and hard. I think everybody else at the table, I think, was just like staring at me, going, "Why is this guy still talking? He hasn't eaten his food. It's cold."
Well, Jeremy, and also I learned you were in San Francisco, so we're going to have to hook up at some point.
I look forward to meeting up with you.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Propaganda, death ensemble, burial to be. Corpses rotting through the night in blood-laced misery. Scorched earth, the policy, the reason for the siege. Pendulum, it shaves the blade, the scraping air blood rage.
I'm here with David Axe, who apparently was an embedded journalist and has a book to offer us. So maybe, David, you could tell us about that.
Sure. For most of 2005, I was an embedded journalist in Iraq, writing for The Village Voice, The Washington Times, Salon.com, and also shooting video for C-SPAN. And I've written a graphic novel called Warfix, which recounts my first trip to Iraq and describes this the strange phenomenon of, I guess you could call it combat addiction, whereby war correspondents and soldiers get hooked on the drama and the pageantry and even the chemical aspects, like the adrenaline of being at war. And it's illustrated by a very talented gentleman named Steve Alexa. The book's War Fix.
And so what is your journalistic background? What publications have you written for, and how long were you embedded in Iraq?
I've now done a grand total of six embeds, six trips to Iraq. Actually, I take that back, five embeds, and then one what they call a unilateral trip where I go essentially on my own and hire my own security. And embed means that I'm traveling with a military unit. So a grand total of 6 trips, 5 embedded, 2 of those with the British Army in southern Iraq. I've been at this for a little over 18 months. I've worked for, as I said before, The Village Voice, The Washington Times, Cosmopolitan, Popular Science. I mentioned Salon.com earlier. I shoot video for C-SPAN, and they run 30-minute news news pieces on a regular basis. I've done a book for University of South Carolina Press that's coming out in the fall called Army 101 that touches on some of my experiences in Iraq. Let's see who else I've written for. More free weekly newspapers than I can count. The Missoulian out of Montana. A number of trade magazines like the Naval Institute Proceedings, Sea Power, National Defense. I blog at defensetech.org. The list goes on. I mean, I've lost track.
Oh, no problem. Well, I mean, that's what writers are. Do you compare your embedded experience with your unilateral experience, and which of these did you draw upon specifically for WarFix? Was it more embedded, or did your unilateral sort of provide more information that perhaps the embedded one did not?
No, that my experiences in Iraq have been so rich and so busy that I could only slice off a tiny portion for WarFix, and it touches on the beginning of my Iraq experience, why I started in this thing in the first place, and what the fallout was in the immediate aftermath of my first trip, because I came home pretty hooked on this stuff, for better or for worse, and it's been great for me professionally, my experiences in Iraq, but personally it's been a disaster. It's hard to sort of hold a life together when you're back and forth between Iraq and Columbia, South Carolina, in my case, and it's especially difficult when your experiences in the conflict are so rich and so important, and then you come home to a place that's easy and peaceful and flat. Now, whether embedding or the unilateral trip, those are very different experiences. I'm very wary about traveling to certain parts of Iraq on my own without military security. I covered the murder of freelancer Steve Vincent in Basra last year for The Village Voice. He had been moving around Basra on his own and had a female interpreter, and having that female interpreter sort of raised some suspicions in the local community that he was in love with a Muslim, which is a no-no in southern Iraq, and so they murdered him. I'm wary of... This is not a conflict where journalists are considered neutral, so I would rather face the prospect of the occasional attack on a convoy or a mortar barrage or whatever than risk getting kidnapped and beheaded. So I don't travel anywhere south of the city of Kirkuk on my own. But in northern Iraq, the Kurdish militia, the Peshmerga, has a pretty a firm hold on things. It's pretty secure, so I feel safe moving around there. And but very different experiences, because south of Kirkuk, it's a war zone. North of that, it's just a third world country struggling to get its economy going. The Kurdistan, as they call it, the Kurdish region, is rich in history and archaeology, and the people are fascinating. So that's more of a cultural immersion experience than it is a combat immersion experience.
Gotcha. Now, how does your book sort of, like, you know, what issues does it raise that have other books have not actually raised?
That's easy. Most journalists love to cloak themselves in this sense of righteousness that they're reporting the tragedy of this conflict with the ultimate goal, I mean, whether they admit it or not, of ending it. I mean, despite the fact that this is their livelihood, at least ideologically speaking, they're opposed to war. But what they're ignoring, or what they don't even know, perhaps, because they haven't spent enough time around the soldiers who are fighting this conflict, is that there are a lot of folks out there who are really having a good time. I mean, there are people, young men mostly, but women too, and I'll tell you about one, but women too, who were meant for this. I mean, we live in a world where there are bad people, there are even bad countries, and there are times when we have to fight, and we need people who can do that. And thank God that we have people who are meant for it, and who, for one reason or another, enjoy it. Now, there's another side to that, which is that these folks can get hooked on, like on a drug, they can get hooked on war, much to their detriment. But that there are folks that are even predisposed to fighting this conflict for us is something we should be grateful for. We need them to keep us free and keep us safe. Now, I do want to tell you about one, the most combat-addicted person I ever met, who's unfortunately not featured in this book. She was a Marine Corps fighter pilot named Judy Vallely, and she told me a story of chasing an insurgent down a street in Ramadi in her F-18 fighter jet. So you can imagine an F-18 against one lone dude, you know, in trousers with an AK-47 who's hauling ass down the street trying to get away from this jet. Because he had been planting roadside bombs, which are the major killer of U.S. troops in Iraq. And, you know, it's U.S. Marine Corps, it's a small organization. This guy had been killing Judy's comrades and friends. So she chased his ass down this street with her F-18 and blew him to pieces with a cannon, with the gun in the nose of her jet. And she told this story with this glimmer, this hungry twinkle. That's a terrible metaphor. But with this sense of excitement and this aggressive attitude that is perhaps an indication that this poor girl is hooked on this stuff. But thank God she's out there doing this so the rest of us don't have to.
Would you say that someone has to sort of be kind of hooked on war in order to actually do their job effectively as a soldier?
Absolutely not. And in fact, there are many soldiers who hate war and hate fighting. They do it. Why they joined in the first place, I don't know. Maybe they just needed the money. Maybe they needed the discipline. Maybe it was a family tradition. But they go, they do their tours in Iraq, and they come home, and they're happy to have it over with. But then there are folks who fight to stay. I was in the town of Balad, and was approached by two young soldiers who begged me to help, as a journalist, to help them pressure their governor into sending a letter to their National Guard unit, allowing them to stay in Iraq after their deployment was scheduled to be over. So there are folks out there who are having a great time, but they really are a minority. It's maybe 10% of the military's, you know, these combat junkies.
Well, David, thank you so much. So I'm here with George Sithers of Wildside Press. He is also the man responsible for reviving Weird Tales magazine. Maybe you could tell us about that and what's coming up from Wildside.
Almost 15 years ago, John Betancourt and Daryl Schweitzer and I decided that we'd like to revive Weird Tales. I had been editor of Amazing Stories, and they no longer wanted me, and I was getting bored. Anyway, we revived the magazine, and it's been clunking along ever since. We're up to issue number 340, with the issue that I have in my hot little hand right now, which has stories by Jay Lake and Tanith Lee, Sarah Hoyt, and Holly Phillips. We got interviewed by the Washington Post a little while ago, and the Los Angeles Times was good enough to pick up the article and run it also.
Now, the new Weird Tales and the old Weird Tales, what are sort of the overlapping kind of qualities, and what are the things that you've sort of changed to kind of, like, you know, update Weird Tales? What have you been conscious of, and what steps have you taken to do this?
We've tried to put out what the magazine would be if it had continued, rather than digging it up and exhuming it. In other words, things have changed. When Weird Tales was first published, there was no such thing as science fiction in the sense that the word had not even been invented. We carried science fiction, speculative fiction, if you will, as well as vampires and ghoulies and ghosts. We published the material of H.P. Lovecraft, who's unfortunately dead, so we can't do any more new stories by him. We published the original stories by Robert E. Howard of Conan the Conqueror and the like. And unfortunately, he's dead, and we can't do any more by him. And we also published Robert Block. And alas, he's dead too. And a few years ago, we published some poems by Ray Bradbury, who's still alive, we're happy to say.
Yes.
But the modern science fiction stories are pretty well handled by specialized science fiction magazines, so that nowadays Weird Tales has closed its scope a little bit, basically supernatural horror. And every so often, because we must occasionally surprise the reader who expects everything to be supernatural, occasionally the vampire may turn out to be a fake. Not every time, but you know, every 10 or 15 years we'll run a story in which the ghost has a real explanation.
So you
generally it's a fantasy-based horror magazine, or fantasy, which isn't always horror. Sword and sorcery, yes.
Now, who would you say would be like, you know, what? Which of your contributing writers would be like the current sort of Lovecraft block, et cetera, or someone who is a sort of talent outside of that, but who is distinctive enough and yet also weird tales enough?
That's impossible to say. There isn't any contemporary Lovecraft, because Lovecraft was his own thing.
Yeah.
And Lovecraft didn't exhaust, but worked over his particular mythos so well that it's quite difficult to do another story in that. Now and then someone does. But in the current issue, Holly Phillips is a creature of her own, and that's an entirely new thing. Tanith Lee has her own particular kind of fantasy, which is not the same thing every time. She's all over the place. I can't really say that we've got one particular author. We'd love to have Stephen King all the time, but Stephen King does books these days, and we're essentially a short story market.
Do you have problems because of these? There's always all these kind of claims that the short story is dead. There are literary magazines that are sort of just struggling to get by. Has any of this kind of like, you know, affected Weird Tales in terms of like putting out issues or attracting talent, or even like, you know, maybe some people, maybe you can like comment upon these issues?
As far as the supply of short stories, no problem. This is, if anything, I hate to say this, but we almost have too many writers in the field now.
Yeah.
Our problem is that people do not go to cigar stores and magazine stores to the extent that they used to. Magazine circulation used to be in the hundreds of thousands, and then the tens and tens of thousands, and now in the low tens. And this is a problem throughout the fiction field. There aren't an awful lot of fiction magazines. The Digest group, Asimov's Analog, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, and on the other side, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine and Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. All of these have decreasing circulation over the years. As far as the availability of material, the thing is that there are annual courses on how to teach science fiction. I've been publishing books on how to write science fiction. I've been publishing guidelines on science fiction. As far as the supply of good material, there's plenty. I see a higher percentage of viable material nowadays. Back in the Asimov's days, when I first started in this line of work, which is about 1978, I figured about 1% of what I got in would be fit to put on the page. I'm seeing a higher percentage of stuff that's fit to put on the page, but I can't buy all of the stuff that's fit to put on the page because there's so much of it.
How much of a higher percentage are you seeing now?
I can't say a percentage because I'd have to sit down and count how many manuscripts and how many got the good but not irresistible reply, and how many got the please don't keep making the same mistakes over and over again reply, and how many got the get a hold of Strunk and White and you better believe it. Strunk and White is the essential book on composition, on how to write. It's a thin volume. It's extremely good. You learn how the standard way to write. You change away from that for deliberate effect. You find that you're disagreeing with it, and then as you get better, you find that they were right all along. They're talking about the general case, and what you're writing is a special case. Standard English is what you frame around dialogue, but what's between the quote marks is how people actually speak, which isn't precisely literary. It isn't precisely grammatical. And you vary from being precisely literary and grammatical in order to call attention to how people are speaking. In your exposition part of a story, if you want to call attention to what you're doing, then you start breaking some of the rules. But if you drop into standard grammar, then all that comes across is what words are you choosing and in what order do you put them down, which is the basic of writing. It's the basic of poetry, too, as Coleridge put it.
Yeah. Well, I'm going back to this issue of, like, more manuscripts are suitable. It's just a question of finding the ones that are right for Weird Tales. Do you think that the rise of MFA workshops might have something to do with this, or...?
I don't know MFA workshop, because I know that there are a great many workshops over the years, over the decades. So I'm not aware of what MFA workshop is doing. Tell me about it.
Well, like, you know, workshops for people who get MFA degrees in creative writing.
Right.
And so there are all these, you know, workshops around short stories. And so therefore you have this kind of like cottage industry almost of aspiring writers who are then perhaps like flooding what it sounds like Weird Tales along with the remaining sort of literary magazines and journals that we have in order to, you know, actually get some credits. So I'm wondering if this, I'm sort of speculating out loud, but maybe you as an editor.
Of course you are. The thing about workshops is, if somebody is off in a garret writing all by himself, he'll start writing for himself, and this is not good. So working with other people is helpful. But you have to remember that the opinion of somebody who is close enough to you that you could hit them is not as good as somebody on the far end of a email line or of a mail line. In the end, however, the only opinion that really matters is that of somebody who might pay you money for it.
I guess I was sort of just kind of getting a sense of, like, you know, do you think that this is possibly sort of, do you think that the MFA mentality of, like, sort of a approval by committee is kind of perhaps, you know, damaging, particularly, like, you know, when we were talking about genre fiction like Weird Tales, where these MFA workshops...
Yes. Your problem is that in the group, if somebody is using the group for other than learning how to write and helping other people to write, then you're in trouble. And you have to keep your antenna out for just exactly this phenomenon. That if somebody's trying to dominate the group, somebody's trying to show how much better he is or how much less good, that's not the point of a group. The group is, what do the group as a general think is good and bad about what somebody is writing? If the group is turning over people who are becoming so busy selling that they no longer have time for the group, that's a successful group. If the group is a static group who simply get together to argue with each other, this is a kind of a trap. The bouncing things off of other people is a faster way of getting a feel for it than sending it off by mail. But the opinion you get back by mail from somebody who might buy it and thinks it was good enough to say what's wrong with it, that's important. The kind of things that I see over and over is somebody starts with a resume. I'm not buying a resume. I'm buying a story.
Unless the story is actually in the form of a resume.
No. There is a general remark about this, that if you don't get the reader's attention in the first paragraph, the rest of the message is lost. This was written by a rear admiral who presumably was not writing about fiction at the time, but it's still very appropriate. The thing that a writer's group should do is to take a look at a story and say, you know, if you started with the second paragraph, it would be just as good. Well, in fact, it would be a great deal better because the first paragraph is simply getting in your way. And starting the story too late or not starting at all are the most irritating things that come across, other than things that are in such an awful format that I can just throw them back.
Well, George, thanks so much. These were all very interesting things to hear. So,
if you want to see the Weird Tales guidelines, send me an email at weirdtales@comcast.net and ask for our guidelines. They're the best in the business.
Great. Well, thanks so much, George. Thanks.